our strength and growth depends on the strength of others.
Development is charity. It's one of the smartest investments we can make in our shared future.
Well, poverty is not about not having money. Poverty is about living a life that is not to its full potential.
Welcome to the Future Development Podcast, a conversation series from the Paulson Institute for Global Development at Cornell University. Here we engage with ideas and issues across contexts that bear on addressing poverty and inequality in our world. Today on the podcast, we have Professor of Development Sociology, John Sipple. He specializes in studying education and social policy and their effect on communities and schools. Recently, he was appointed as an external expert in East Ramapo, New York, where ethnic and religious tension almost broke a community apart. In the process of studying and mediating in the community on behalf of the state, Professor Sipple found East Ramapo to be an insightful case study representing many of the biggest tensions we see in society, including distrust in news and government, identity politics, and fiscal crisis.
So my name is Peter Fiducia. I am a second year doctoral student in the Department of Development Sociology. And my advisor is Dr. John Sipple. And so in starting the discussion about the East Ramapo project, perhaps you could start by giving us some context, kind of set the scene for what has happened, what's been happening, and the start to your involvement in the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my involvement started in 2014 when I was driving home one day, listening to a This American Life podcast on this crazy situation in what a town called East Ramapo, New York. And it was so engaging. I sat in my driveway for the last half hour listening to this until it was over, partly feeling enraged and partly feeling interested. Years went by, and I thought not one minute about this situation. And I was at a rural sociology conference out in Madison, Wisconsin, when my phone rang in early August, a couple years ago, 3 years ago. And it was the call from the New York State Commissioner of Education's office asking me to do a favor for them. And I said, what favor do you have in mind? And they said, well, have you heard of East Ramapo? And I said, well, I heard the podcast, and that's been my only involvement. And they wanted me to be one of three people in New York State to go in and study the heck out of the situation and make recommendations on what the state should do about it.
And just for those of us who may not have some information about the context about the district, could you provide some background information about the size, the location?
So the community of East Ramapo is located in a kind of a suburban community outside New York City, probably 45 minutes north of New York City, just across the Tappan Zee Bridge. And it's a community that, you know, 30, 40 years ago was a very, relatively well-to-do, solidly middle-class African-American population and white population. And in the early 1960s, the very first of the Orthodox Jews moved up from Brooklyn into this community. And in the span from 1960s to about 2005, that population grew from one person, one family, to a rather large and rapidly growing population of Orthodox Jews living in this community. So you had a situation where you had a school district of about 9 or 10,000 students, typically white and African American, that then rapidly was undergoing some rapid changes. And the most significant change was this growth of the non-public school sector, because by definition, Orthodox Jewish children do not attend public schools. By definition, they go to yeshivas. And that number grew from, you know, 1,000 to 5,000 to 15,000. And today there's 27,000 non-public children attending these yeshivas in the community. While that was taking place, the public school population shifted from this relatively well-to-do white and black community with about 5% poor kids to today there's about a 77% poor kids in the community. There used to be 0% English language learners. Now there's about 40% English language learners, with a huge Hispanic population of immigrants, Haitian immigrants. And so it's become a community of immigrants attending public schools and a lot of poor children attending public schools, with a massive group of of Orthodox children attending the non-public schools. So what made this community unique and different was the demographic change, but also the change to leadership of the public school board. In 2006, there became a fifth member of the board that was of the Hasidic and Orthodox Jewish faith to take over control of the public school board. So it's a nine-member board. They got a majority of votes in 2006, and that all of a sudden changed the dynamic of what they were voting for. Between then and my involvement in that began in 2015, you had massive budget cuts, which also were involved, were also driven by the massive recession of 2008. And the recession and the overtaking of the school board by the Orthodox community go hand in hand, and you cannot separate those two phenomena as you're telling the story.
And you had mentioned your involvement started in 2015. Can you speak a little bit more about how that opportunity was presented and how you started mm-hmm. to formalize that?
Yeah, so the state commissioner asked me to be part of a three-person team of monitors to go in and study and try to understand just what should be done, what should the state do. There was six budget failures voted on by the public over about a nine-year span. There was a massive budget deficit. There had been a $12 million fund balance for the district. There were now $8 million in the red. So there's a fiscal crisis. There was a social crisis. There was all kinds of mistrust, yelling at each other, physical confrontations. There was the concern that the community was about to explode. And the state needed finally to do something about this in 2015. And so I began with a gentleman by the name of Dennis Walcott, who had used to run the New York City Public Schools under Mayor Bloomberg. And he was our lead monitor. And there's another woman, Monica George Fields, who was an instructional and curriculum expert. And I was brought in as the financial expert to assess the finances of the district, make recommendations on what to do, and to try to bring some calm insanity to this really, really crazy, inflamed situation in this community. So we began our work in August of 2015. I had a public hearing in September of 2015 when the public just came out, filled an auditorium, screaming and yelling about all the injustice, all the criminal activity, all the lies, all the accusations of racism and so forth. But as we got involved, all that is there's evidence of much of that, not all, but much of that, and there's also screaming on the other side that the community was acting in all these anti-Semitic ways, and accusing the board of activities that were not true either. So we got into the situation where there's a million accusations. Everyone had a story, and we had to filter out and sort out where the truth was, and ultimately figuring out what to do. The public hearing we had was the first of the diffusing of the situation, the first pressure release on the system, because people were there to listen to a group of people that had felt abandoned, had felt abused by the board and others, abandoned by the state. And so we began a process of diffusing. The public began to see that there was folks interested in hearing their story and had some degree of power to do something about it. So we began to listen and met with a million people individually, all kinds of local community groups, with the educators. We replaced the superintendent very, very quickly. The school board had already replaced its board president. And we began the process of trying to uncover and decipher what really had happened. And in a nutshell, how much of the blame should be put on the Orthodox-led board, and how much the blame should we put on the recession, how much blame should we put on other interactions in the community. We did not find any criminal activity amongst the board. I was asked many, many times, have you found criminal activity? At that public hearing that night, there's that one gentleman who was yelling at us saying, anything short of you calling the FBI and have the FBI arrest the entire board is an abject failure. Well, we didn't find any criminal activity. What we found really is a set of people in the community who are advocating on behalf of their children. And their children have a right to an education, whether it be in a public school or private school. racial minority children have a right covered by the 14th Amendment, that they that the race should not inhibit their freedoms, should not inhibit their rights and responsibilities as a citizen, and hence their right to an education and transportation to their schooling and so forth. And these people were acting on behalf of their kids very passionately, that their kids were being shortchanged because of all the budget cuts. True, absolutely true. On the other side, the Orthodox community was advocating on behalf of their children. This happens all over New York State, where public school students are bused at public expense, and non-public school students are bused at public expense. In most communities, no one ever notices because it's such a small number. In this community, you have three times as many non-public students as public, and so you have a huge expense. There's over $30 million of transportation costs every year just for transporting the nearly 40,000 students in the district. And that cost is what made this controversial. It's not, they have a right to that transportation, but the cost was extreme. So what you have is a question of whether or not one child's rights covered by the 14th Amendment are more important than a different child's rights covered by the First Amendment. And I vowed from day one in my involvement, and I'll state it again today publicly, I'm not going to have that conversation of which kids' rights are more important. Both sets of kids have rights, and they should get what they're due. What I have learned, because of all the budget failures and because of the tax cap that the property tax cap that New York State instituted in 2011, is that the district is way underspending for the children that they have responsibility for. The trick is the district is constrained with their budget and does not have enough money to spend on both of those children. And so you get this real deep-rooted tension fighting over the limited resources in the community. So the fiscal crisis in the district is by and large over, and the fund balance that had been $12 million in the black, which was then spent down to $8 million in the red, we now have a $7 million fund balance back. So we got a healthy fund balance in place. The Office of State Comptroller has removed this district from its list of fiscally stressed districts. The Moody's has changed its bond rating for the district and moved it up. So a lot of the traditional fiscal indicators are moving in the right direction. And so the fiscal crisis is over. The social crisis is not over. The educational crisis is not over. There's a spike in dropouts this past year or two. There's a lot of work to do in the schools to make sure that we're meeting the needs of a very different population that the school district needs to serve today than it served 25 years ago. Some of the older teachers were around back in the days when there were no poor kids, there were no immigrants, everyone spoke English. And now they're still continuing to teach in a district that you have a lot of poor kids, you have a lot of immigrants, and a lot of kids are learning English. What I found over and over again was people had a story, people had an accusation, and the accusation might have been that there's $20 million stolen by the school board. That's why they wanted the FBI to come in and arrest all the board members. Well, there was not $20 million stolen by the school board. The school board spent $20 million of fund balance. That's the big difference between spending and stealing. So one of my strategies was to bring data to the table. And when people were arguing that there's no money being spent on X or too much money being spent on Y, I would bring in the dollars. Well, how many, here's how many dollars have been spent over the years on this program. And often the data being brought in, the evidence being brought to bear, would squelch many of the accusations. Really interesting issues of legitimacy, of whose fact counts, whose word counts in a community. And what we found, what I personally found, was that because I came from Cornell University, I didn't come from the state, I didn't come from the federal government, I didn't come from one of the other established state entities, that I was viewed as a third party. And I think that was actually quite important. I brought some legitimacy to the table as an independent third party person studying this, gathering data, talking to all kinds of people. It's really interesting to think about what is the appropriate role for an academic involved in local communities, because we can all care. We might even know something about the local issues, but we're not part of that local community. So what is our role? And I thought about this quite a bit as I was interacting down there, and I think I had some good success in being open and listening and not bringing in my own biases and my own premature thoughts on different issues.
So the fiscal challenges, the contextual, community level challenges that you and your team have been facing are informing and will be explored in more detail in a upcoming title that you're a book that you're putting together. If you'd be so kind as to explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it became apparent to me this past year that all the good work by local advocates, public officials in the community should be told broadly and should be shared broadly, because the struggles that they're facing there, while the details of it are unique with a very, very large ultra-Orthodox population and a large immigrant population, the details may be, demographic details may be unique. The issue of a community polarization has become very, very commonplace across the country. This issue of a polarized country, the issue of polarized groups that get their information from different sources, that interact in an insular way, is part of this broader national conversation we're having right now in the United States and elsewhere across the world. So rather than trying to get our heads around how we can, as an American society, come together and move past this polarization, which is a really, that's a tough task right there, given the immense scope of the country. What if we looked into a single community, a single population, and looked at these struggles, the challenges, the strategies of polarization and the move beyond polarization? So we're trying to illustrate in the book the really, really, really good work of these people trying to advocate on behalf of their kids. And the fact that the outside looks at this as two communities fighting against each other, fighting tooth and nail, not trusting, really engaging in conversation that demeans the other side. When you actually hang around the community and meet these people, there's much less of that than you might expect. And there's really people caring about their own children. And so the process moving forward is not going to be a big top-down government solution. It's not going to be a big top-down party solution from different parties. It's really local communities taking, you know, exerting their agency in their community, saying, this is our community. We're going to move forward. We're going to befriend our neighbors. We're going to work through our differences. And I think there's a lot of reason to believe, when you look at the details of what this book will describe, that the outside perception often misses and glosses over the really good community level development work that's being done in this particular community.
Thank you so much for listening. If there's anything that sparked your curiosity from the conversation today, please check the show notes for links and other resources. Polson Institute Future Development Podcast is planning on releasing more episodes, so please check back soon.